The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, thank you for coming to this book event. I've never done one of these before. And so I didn't know what was supposed to happen. And a big part of doing it was because I really wanted to thank the so many people who helped make the book possible. Trouble hearing? Is it better now? So it was kind of a way of publicly thanking some people who put a lot of time into helping and encouraging me and believing in this book. And Diana Clark, who's trying to be anonymous over there in the back corner. No one's supposed to look at her, but she, you know, she was really a delight to work with, and wonderful editor, and without her, it wouldn't have come to fruition at all. And then Elena did a fantastic job. She was the one who designed the book, and designed it and laid it out, and then had to deal with the finicky author. I understand now why publishers don't want authors involved in the process, but it was lots of fun with Diana and Elena, and just kind of exploring the font and the design, and this was really learning that side of the business in a sense. That was really neat. So it was really wonderful to work with Elena and Inez Friedman was it's always been such a big supporter, and has edited so many of my things over the years and supported me in so many different ways. And she was also there helping with this, and I sent drafts to her. She edited and made all kinds of corrections and support. And who else is anybody else that's here? That's really the three primary people. So other people also who helped Nona help with it, and other people that I thank in the book. And my wife Tamara, yes.
And Torin.
My son, he was... He got really into the design aspects of the book, and he actually made the first mock-up kind of drafts of a cover that he tried his hand on. So I liked it. There was a group process, many people involved. And in a way, the stories themselves are a group process because they came out of the lives of so many people who... in the course of their practice, you know, my years of practice, which was really a collective practice. I practiced in monasteries with so many people, and the events of those time together told there's lots of stories to tell, and some of those kind of informed these stories, and then since then there's other stories. Some of the stories in the book actually come from conversations that I've had either as a teacher with someone or as a student. And one of the stories, many years ago, I was giving a Dharma talk. This is like 13 years ago or so, a Dharma talk at Kanando, which is a Zen center in Mountain View. And I gave it my talk, and then in the kind of Zen style of kind of like, you know, pointed, you know, questions that are kind of like confronting you. Here at IMC, people are so kind, the questions. But in Zen, they kind of like, you know, give, you know, much more challenging. And so I think it was Nancy Smee, who now sits here and with us. She raised her hand in the Zendo, and she was the one who asked me, "How do you know if you waste time?" And I heard myself say, "If you're suffering." And I thought that was a great answer. I didn't say that at the time. But that became one of the stories. So that's the origin of one story. And the last story in the book was near the end of putting the book together. I had a phone talk. I'm kind of like a spiritual mentor or something for a man who's now, I think he's 94, and he's been a Zen priest for 40-some years. And before that, he had a very rich life. he was pulled in front of the American, the Un-American Activities Committee, was that what it was called?
Yes.
The House Un-American Activities. Yeah, he was pulled in front of there because of his, and then he was blacklisted and he couldn't find work. And before that, he was a radio announcer in San Francisco, and before that, he was a minister and preacher and a very rich life. And he was the one who was telling me on the phone, you know, I've done so many things in my life, you know, I got so involved in this thing. And then first it was Christianity, and then it was being a doctor, and then it was being a Marxist, and then it was being, you know, a radio announcer, and then it's now and then Buddhism. And it's just all, you know, stories. I just see they're all empty now, and what do I do now? And so I said to him, well, now, you know, now you listen to other people's stories. And then I told that to my wife, and she said, that has to be in the book. And so that's how that got in the book. And so stories, here's a story that didn't make it in the book. So in the land of this monastery, there was a king and a queen, and they had a baby prince who was going to become the next king of the land. And so many people came with gifts for the baby. They came with gold and diamonds and silver. And you know, so lots of beautiful, expensive things, you know, because that's what, you know, what do you give to a king or a prince? But the abbess of the monastery, she came also with a gift. And her gift was on a small scroll. And on the scroll, it said, every week, I will send you a story. And she did. And the boy grew up. And which of those gifts that he got as a baby do you think helped him to be a wise king, wise ruler? All those stories, they counted, you know. The stories themselves are kind of wealth, that they're much more valuable than a lot of other things that people think are valuable. Because they speak to our, something deep inside of us. They speak to, you know, hopefully they speak wisdom. They speak about our human condition. They evoke different perspectives on our lives, sometimes in surprising ways. They can be places where we engage and question our lives. They can become mirrors for our lives. And so they kind of have this life. And they also, in some ways, they tie us to other people. We share stories. There are some scholars who say that what religion really is a group of people who share the same story. So like here, you know, Buddhism, we share particular stories, you know, the Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree, and we tell that story a lot. and still to this day, I think it was today I was talking to someone, where the story of the Buddha touching the earth as part of his enlightenment story, she remembered it at a time when she was offering spiritual care to someone in hospital, and she was really challenged by how difficult it is to be with people in crisis who are dying. And so she remembered that Buddha was challenged in the night of his enlightenment and touched the earth. So she thought, I have to do something similar. And so she found next time she went to the hospital, she brought a little stone to hold in her hand. And then she could go through the see the patients and feel much more grounded. So she had the story of the Buddha touching the earth. And that's a story that was meaningful for her in a time of being a mentor or supporter for other people in crisis. Stories do many things. And there's a Chinese kind of Zen story, or Chinese story, of a fisherman who was fishing with a straight hook. And people came to me and said, you know, you can't catch a fish with a straight hook. And he said to the people, he said, oh, if you want to catch an ordinary fish, you have to have a hooked hook, a bent hook. But if you want to catch a really great fish, you need a straight hook. It's not really a hook, right? A straight And so this story about this fisherman who was fishing with a straight hook traveled around the country. And the emperor of China heard about him, and he said, "I want to go see this fool." So he went to the fisherman and said, "What are you doing? Everyone knows you can't catch a fish with a straight hook. And you can't catch a great fish with a straight hook." And the fisherman said, "Oh, yes, you can. You're the great fish I was catching." That was the bait to get the emperor to come. So these stories were your bait. And you came today, tonight. And I kind of offered the book in these kinds of stories with a hope that people would not just casually read the stories and, you know, just kind of nod they liked it or shake their head if they don't or throw it across the room or something. But rather, they would sit and go back and revisit the stories and engage the stories, think about the stories. Because one of the aspects of, I think, one of the opportunities in life is to discover wisdom, not in something like a text, but by how you engage in the text, how you explore it and look at it. Everything has a benefit some way or other. And you could either judge and say, "That was a bad story." Or you could say, "How is this useful for me? How can I look at this in a way that becomes more useful?" And if you do that exercise, then it becomes useful, then it becomes helpful. But sometimes it takes time to enter the story, to reflect on it, to think about it, to be challenged by it. And sometimes the things we dislike about the story are the very things we're going to learn the most from. So these are meant as teaching stories or learning stories, not really meant for entertainment. And in doing that, they go along with a long, long tradition in Buddhism and maybe other religions as well of using stories to teach. And it goes back to the time of the Buddha. The Buddha, as far as I could tell, he was making up stories all the time. Nowadays, people think that, you know, some people believe that, you know, there's, you know, some strange, I don't know, I mean, some people believe in them, but I think there are all these myths. I think he was a storyteller, and he found it very useful to tell stories to get across what he had to teach. Like the story that I like a lot of the ugly little runt of a yaksha. A yaksha is like a little troll, maybe. Maybe. You know, ugly, you know, but it's kind of like a tree spirit, kind of. And this ugly little runt of a troll went up to heaven and climbed up on Brahma's throne. Now, Brahma's like the great lord of certain heaven up there. You know, he's a pretty hot guy. And, you know, you don't go sit in the throne of Brahma. That's like a disrespectful thing. But he was away, and so he got up there. But all the court gods around saw this, and they said, "You got to get down." But the yaksha didn't get down. And so they started kind of being angry with him and saying, "You have to get down from there." And the more angry they got, the bigger and more beautiful and stronger this little troll became. Until he was this huge, beautiful, radiant being. And so the other gods got kind of confused, so they went and found Brahma and said, "Brahma, look, there's something going on back at your court. I think you need to come and take care of it." So Brahma came back. And he stood in front of his own throne and bowed to the yaksha and said, "Oh, it's so nice to see you. I hope you're comfortable and, you know, hope you're well," and offered him respect. And as he was offering his kindness to the troll got smaller and smaller and smaller, and finally, poop, disappeared. So then Brahma got up on his throne, and then he explained, "That was an anger-eating yaksha. And the more angry you were, the more it was fed. And if you stop feeding it anger, it disappears." So that's a great story, teaching story, because you probably have yakshas of your own. you know, that you feed and develop with your anger or your things. And so then to reflect, you know, what is it I feed? How is it my anger, my greed, and what does that reinforce and build inside of me? And that story is so graphic. And you can even tell it to a child, and the child can get it in a deeper way than if you just tell a child, you know, by the way, if you keep doing the same thing, it strengthens it. That's not going to go very far. But you tell a story, and it kind of touches the heart, or something different happens. I think also stories speak to a different part of our mind than logic does, or reasoning. And the structures of language, the structures of thinking, the structures of self that we live under, many of them are not so conscious. We don't see how all these things interact. And we don't necessarily understand the full range of our emotional life and what motivates us and what speaks to us. And you know, that's partly why people have dreams. And stories kind of reach in there and tap and touch into places that are deep inside and meaningful to us, that move us, that maybe belong to some of the subconscious or parts of ourselves or parts of us that we don't really see, and move them and change them. And then you might argue, well, that's kind of manipulating people if you tell stories to kind of touch their hearts and get them to have, you know, feel all these emotions and open their hearts and all that. And I really, what Buddhism is just kind of, you just tell the truth, it's direct and logical, and you're not supposed to, you know, cater to people's emotions with the story. But the Buddha did that. Not only did he tell stories, but he actually said that in his, that when he gave a Dharma talk, he was preparing people for deeper teachings. And so he taught in such a way to soften their hearts and to inspire them and to open them so they're ready to hear something that could go, you know, really make an impact. Yeah, it's, you know, kind of obvious thing. I mean, if you have a very busy day and you have a headache and feel harried and you didn't manage to do all the things you're supposed to do and there's people angry with you, and, you know, you come to IMC and someone gives a Dharma talk here and you have no patience for it. You know, you're not even open, you don't even, couldn't care less, you know. And you even sound stupid. But then you come someday and you're relaxed and soft and open, and the same talk, you know, same teaching, you know, touches something, drops down deeper into, touches something, and there's space in the mind for it, there's space in the heart for it. So I think stories speak to a much bigger part of, you know, to a wide range of who we are that's very different than a didactic teaching. A, B, and C, this is the list. And I can give you a list of the five kinds of stories. And that, you know, that's not going to go very far, unless the lists are fun. And so these stories are kind of meant as teaching and learning stories to spend time with, to reflect on. Some of the stories, you know, I kind of thought maybe we're not quite ever finished. And the one that's kind of meant to be most unfinished is the one about the path. And so, should I read it? I suppose it's a book reading, right? But I'm afraid all of you have read it already. When arriving at the monastery, new monks and nuns would commonly ask the abbess for instructions on the path of practice. If they were insistent enough about finding the path, the abbess would take them to a remote corner of the monastery garden where people seldom went. There she pointed them to a narrow walkway that disappeared into the bushes and trees. She told them, "You will find the path at the end of this walkway." Then the old abbess turned away, leaving each novice to walk on alone. Intrigued, the new monastic set off in search of the path. Before long, however, the trail took a sharp turn. When they rounded the corner, they came face to face with a very large mirror. It blocked their way. Seeing their own image reflected in the mirror confused them. Some wondered, "Maybe I have taken the wrong path." Still, no matter how many times they tried to retrace their steps or start over, sooner or later they found the mirror blocking their way again. More than a few assumed the mirror was placed on the trail to show them that the real path was in them, not in the external world. This understanding frightened some, and they ran away. Others collapsed in hopelessness. Some simmered in anger. Occasionally, someone would become so upset they would hurl a heavy rock at the reflection. The mirror, however, was impervious. Each time they threw a rock at it, the stone bounced back and struck them instead. There were some monastics who lingered in front of the mirror, each gazing at his or her own likeness. It mesmerized and delighted them. Their conceit spilled over as they perceived themselves as somehow being the great Buddhist path. And of course, there were those novices who simply tried to walk around the mirror. Believing it blocked their way, they plunged headlong into the surrounding thicket of bushes, only to emerge scratched and bloodied by an impenetrable web of thorns and undergrowth. From time to time, one of them would see his or her mother or father standing next to them in the reflection. This was an eerie sight, since they knew they were alone. At other times, the reflected image was obscured by crowds of people. In due course, some of the monks and nuns calmed down enough to stop and look carefully into the reflection. For many, it was the first time they ever really looked deeply into themselves. More than a few concluded that the mirror and the reflection were the end of the path. Those who did ended up stuck for a very long time. Others, however, remembered the abbess's directive about finding the path at the end of this walkway. When these monks and nuns stopped and looked deeply into their likeness in the mirror, a wonderful realization arose in their minds. The reflection is me, but I am not the reflection. Then, when they reached out and lightly touched the mirror, it gave way. Like a great door silently swinging open, it revealed a bright, expansive, sunlit section of garden, unlike anything they could ever have imagined existed. So you think that's a good place to end the story, right? But the last sentence says, just beyond, at the edge of the path, stood the old abbess holding two shovels. So what does that mean? What's the thing about two shovels? They just made it, you know, through the path. What is, you know, so that's supposed to be a challenge to you to consider, what's this thing about two? This person just got enlightened, you know, and two shovels? What's that about? So, you know, two shovels means, in my mind, I don't know what it means, but I can tell you what I think it means. two shovels means that it's one for the abbess and one for the monastic. They're both going to, and being enlightened doesn't mean your practice stops. It means there's more work to be done. You still got to dig in the garden. You still have to continue. But now you do it together. So that's the, you know, there's still no enlightened retirement. And for me, as I wrote this story, there's, in the background was all kinds of ideas that are kind of, some of them are not so obvious to many of you, probably not at all, but they're kind of tucked away. Various ideas coming from the history of Buddhist thought are kind of embedded in the story. So if you know about Buddhism or Buddhist philosophy, some of these things would jump out. Like a small thing, perhaps, would be this saying, the wonderful realization, the reflection is me, but I am not the reflection. And that's a great, it's very intriguing. Why is that such an important insight? And so then you engage with it, you question it, you wonder what it, all about it. But the, in Zen, in Japan, there's two schools of Zen. There's Rinzai and Soto Zen. And in Soto Zen, the founder of Soto Zen, when he had his enlightenment, was characterized by that sentence, by that statement. He was looking over a bridge into the river below, and he saw his reflection. And he saw, the reflection is me, but I am not the reflection. So it's not original with me, this, right? But this is a really important statement for people who know about the history of Zen. So here it is. like, as you know, it's not just so. So again, what does it mean? How is this useful for you? And that's for you to engage in. And then all these lists of things, how people, you know, become frightened, they run away when they see the mirror, they collapse in hopelessness, they simmer in anger, they throw rocks at it. I was kind of thinking that most people would maybe see a little hints of themselves there. Because, you know, spiritual life, Buddhist practice, isn't usually kind of just straight, you know, straight line for enlightenment. The path is challenging, especially when you realize that in order to walk the path, you have to go through yourself. And I'll tell you a story of my own life. I think it's a good story. This actually happened. Maybe many of you heard the story. I was a new Zen student, and I would go sit with a small Zen group in Davis, and it was a very small little bedroom and we would sit, meditate. And so we would, as in Zen style, you sit with your eyes open facing the wall, but because it's so small, we basically knees were almost touching the wall, this bedroom. And I sat down in my good Zen posture, and this big, majestic Roman column rose up in front of me. And I'm not prone to hallucination, but this big column rose up in front of me, and the kind of thing that shows, like a bank, shows that a bank has a lot of authority and power and trustworthiness. And then written down in black, engraved black painted letters on this column were the letters Z-E-N, Zen, and the pillar of Zen. And so then I went to embrace that pillar. And as I embraced it, it disappeared and I fell forward and hit my head against the wall of the bedroom. So that got my attention. And what it taught me was that I shouldn't relate to Buddhism or Zen as this great, big, authoritative thing out there that I was supposed to get and have. There is no Zen, actually. I believe there actually is no Buddhism, in a real way. But there is a profound confrontation meeting of yourself and seeing yourself that opens up to the freedom that the Buddha was pointing towards. So sooner or later, the mirror has to be on you. And then what do you see, and how do you react to what you see? Do you run away? Do you collapse? Do you despair? Do you throw rocks? What do you do? Some of the stories in here are very brief, if they can be called stories, but they're kind of meant to kind of have a little twist in the usual way of thinking about things, so that it kind of opens a little space in your mind, so that maybe you think about yourself or your issues or something in a different way. One evening, the abbess taught, "Your problems won't be solved in this monastery." So that must be disappointing to everyone to hear that. I mean, well, the monks and nuns had come there to really kind of overcome their problems that they have. But no, your problems won't be solved in this monastery. They will be dissolved. And my hope is when people have read that, they would think, oh, maybe the way that I'm relating to my so-called problems, maybe there's another way of looking at it. Maybe there are problems, or maybe the solution is not found in the way I usually think of them. There's some other way. What's that other way? To dissolve them rather than solve them. What's that? He's going to so open some new possibilities, some other perspective. That was my hope. A young monk complained of having too many distractions to be able to meditate. And I think most people who meditate think that. Probably many of you do. He explained to the abbess that he had tried every possible approach to overcome the distractions. He had redoubled his efforts at concentration. He had been diligent in trying to let the distractions go. He had also tried many antidotes, including ignoring them. When none of these approaches worked, he even tried turning toward the distractions to include them as part of the meditation. He had also investigated the reactions, feelings, and beliefs he had in relationship to the distractions. None of this had helped. He remained plagued. So I try to list some of the more common techniques that I might teach someone. Or, you know, in the Vipassana movement, we say, you know, here's what you can try doing if you have some problems, some distractions, and this is how you deal with it. But what do you do when none of this works? What do you do when Gil gives you bad advice that's not relevant for you? In that case, said the abbess, there remains only one thing for you to do. Please. I like it that she says please. So respectful. Please gaze upon the distractions with kindness and be still. And this idea of gazing upon whatever, anything, your problems, your difficulties, gaze upon them with kindness and be still. I think that to me is a very powerful practice and powerful thing. It doesn't mean you're going to change it or solve it, get rid of it. But you kind of are kind, you're friendly to it, kind of acceptance, allowance. But then you become still and see what happens, see what goes on. Maybe that's all that needs to happen. Some of the stories I'm perplexed by. So if you're perplexed by them, the monastery librarian was an intelligent and inquisitive nun who had lived there for 25 years. She told a story about first coming to the monastery. As a young woman, I was passionately interested in the truth. After years of unsuccessful searching, I brought my quest to the monastery. When I asked the abbess if she would ordain me so I could continue my quest in the monastery, her response confused me and almost prompted me to leave. She said, "If you want to be a nun here, you must follow two rules. First, you must abandon any truth you discover, and second, you must never lie." Perplexed but intrigued, I decided to try the monastic life under these rules. Before I could even begin, I knew I first had to find the truth. When I finally started to have some inkling of what it is, I found it quite challenging to let go of it. I had a lot of doubt about the wisdom of doing so, but as I began to let go of it, I found I felt lighter. I was also more apt to see situations fresh, without preconceived ideas. Dedicating myself to avoiding lying proved even harder to learn. I had no trouble with not speaking ordinary lies to others. I was much more challenged to learn how not to lie to myself. But as I learned, this added to my sense of lightness and ease. By abandoning the truth and never lying, I eventually found what I came to the monastery to find. So I'm a little perplexed by that story. I mean, how does that work? So, you know, so that's... But I find it kind of interesting, you know, that here's a story. I mean, I kind of made up, right? But what does it mean to, why would abandoning the truth and never lying be significant? How might be useful? And I mean, I suggest here you get lighter if you do that, but what might be valuable in that approach? Could it be that religious people, even Buddhists, sometimes cling to the truth? Could it be?
Not taken by views.
Not taken by views. And a couple of stories are, you know, almost not stories. I mean, there's little teachings. But I thought that if I put them in a book like this, these are things I've taught in regular Dharma talks, you know, kind of straightforward way. But I thought they would have a little bit more weight or power in the form of a story like this. A scholar came to the abbess and explained, "I have spent a lifetime studying Buddhism, and it has not helped me much. What am I missing? What is it I need to understand?" To prepare the scholar for her answer, the abbess sat silent for a while. Then she said, breathe in an easy and relaxed way, and then study what causes you to lose that ease. Everything you really need to know about Buddhism will be found in that investigation. So I believe that. It's quite powerful to tune into your breathing and understand what takes away an easeful breath. But and I've taught that here, and some people have found that valuable to hear that teaching. But I had this idea that if I put in a story, it would kind of linger in people's minds, or somehow they'd take it more seriously, or wonder about it more deeply. This story, I hope that would prompt people to consider or rethink more deeply or reconsider what wisdom and compassion really is. Because the title, and titles are very important for the story, is Wisdom and Compassion. When it was time for the monastic community to meditate, the new nun headed for the meditation hall. Placing her shoes on the shoe rack, she looked down and saw they were not lined up parallel to each other. This helped her to see that she was slightly distracted due to the excitement of her first day in the monastery. Letting go of her distraction, she looked more carefully at what was in front of her. She saw that her shoes were old and worn. Remembering when they were new, she reflected on how all things are transient and how quickly they change. Soon, she thought, I will be an old nun in this monastery. Reflecting on how precious each moment was, she reached down to straighten her shoes. Doing so, she noticed that if she moved them to the left, then there would be a space for another pair of shoes to the right of hers. Thinking of the other monks and nuns who were coming to the meditation hall, she gently pushed her shoes to the side. Happy, the new nun entered the meditation hall. So that's a story. But then what does that say about wisdom and compassion? Such a simple, ordinary things, like putting your shoes in the shoe rack, looking at your shoes, moving them aside. That's not Mother Teresa. And that's not the Buddha, you know, the wisdom and compassion. But I think, you know, wisdom and compassion is found in the ordinary details of our life that people are so quick to overlook. There are important things to do, important places to get, and important realizations to have. But perhaps it's in the details that it all unfolds properly. In Zen, they say that Zen, or Soto Zen, they say, one definition of it is attention to detail. That's interesting. That's the whole definition of a religion, attention to detail. And we could almost say that in mindfulness, because mindfulness involves this careful looking at what's actually happening here. We spend a lot of time, Diana and Inez and Bruce helped some, trying to figure out a title for this book. That was a bit of a challenge. We had different ideas, and I really liked Bruce's. What was the one you had? Tales to Sweep You Away. I thought that was nice. Tales to Sweep You Away, but it didn't work for the whole committee. So we hung in there and tried to come up. And finally, we came to this monastery within. And I'm kind of really happy with that. It has a certain kind of something to be taught right there. It's a teaching in the title, I feel. And then it gave us the opportunity to organize these stories in these three different categories as a way of somehow getting across the idea that you can build an inner monastery. You can build these inner qualities of a life through the trainings of Buddhism in kindness, clarity, and wisdom. And I thought that was a nice little teaching thing. And then we organized the teachings. We put them in these three different buckets. And it wasn't a perfect fit, but it was better than not organizing them. Better because it was richer. It was more associations, more kind of prompted more thinking, more ideas, more something. If it was just a series of stories, that would have been fine. But, you know, now there's something a little bit more depth, I hope, in the book because of this association with the three trainings. So here's a modern story that's real about stories. that a few weeks ago I went to the San Francisco Zen Center, and first time I went there was, I suppose, was 35, 36 years ago. When I went there, I was a long-haired hippie, wearing t-shirts and old baggy pants, bald pants, and one of the first books I read when I came there was Zen Flesh, Zen Bones by Paul Reps. It's a great little collection of Zen stories. Those stories, through that book, have become part of our culture almost, some of the stories, and are repeated a lot, and people remember them. And the book, I think, maybe came out in the 50s or something, 60s at first. But there, you know, so I was reading it, and other people were reading the stories, and we'd talk about the stories. And so I was there at Zen Center a few weeks ago, and I came out the front door. They have these steps going down to Page Street. And sitting on the steps in the sun was this young man who probably was 22 with long blonde hair, sitting there in a t-shirt. He had his iPhone or something, or the iPad, you know, with a little box that he was listening to music on. So it was a little different. But otherwise, it was just like, he looked like he's just like, you know, maybe in some ways kind of like he fit in 35 years ago or 45 years ago. And another one of these long-haired, young guys in t-shirts and barefoot or something, sitting there on the steps, hanging out, doing nothing. And you know what he was reading? He was reading Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. Some things don't change. So I don't know how many years this book is going to last, and whether it has any real life, and whether these, you know, I'm curious to see if some of these stories have some life in them outside of the book here or anywhere. Some of the stories I read on retreat, like the story of the pilgrimage, and in the context of retreats, people have been usually silent for a few days, and so sometimes you listen in a very different way if you're in silence, you take it in. And I think when I read these in the retreat, people hadn't heard the story before, so it was the first time. And some people are really moved by this story because, you know, they expect one thing to happen. The monks and nuns are going on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of Buddhism. And then, so that sounds great. India, Bodh Gaya, Saranath, these great places, right? But then they find out that the holy places, the sacred places, are places where someone is sick, hospital, someone is dying, old age home where someone's old. And that kind of, you know, that's sacred. That's, you know, how's that? How does that work? And then to point out that by meeting those and coming through it, there is a place, there's a possibility of finding peace and love in spite of that or with that or with those existential conditions of ours. And I've been quite pleased or happy that this story has moved so many people on retreats when they hear this story. I wasn't quite expecting it, but, you know, that people would be moved. But that's been nice. So maybe that story will have a life for a while. 35 years, we'll, you know, I'll walk out the door here and there'll be somebody sitting on the steps reading A Monastery Within. Something. So those are some of my thoughts to share with you. Do any of you have any questions or things you want to bring up or anything you want to teach me about how to do book reading that I haven't understood what's supposed to happen? Yes.
Was it always an abbess in your mind?
No,
it wasn't. Did you start out with an abbot?
No, it wasn't. In my mind, it was a Zen monastery in the Japanese mountains. And Zen monasteries are unisex. And so I had this, that was the image I had. And I spent time in Zen monasteries in Japan. And so that just kind of what came out, because of that image, that's what came out. Then I started reading some of these stories on retreat. And then Mary Grace Orr, who's a colleague who teaches in Santa Cruz, was teaching with me in that retreat, and she said she appreciated the stories, but she asked me to please have some nuns in the stories as well. And so then for a little bit I stretched, but well, you know, they don't have nuns in those monasteries in Japan. And then I thought, well, who said it has to be in Japan? Who has said it has to be any place? And here, you know, I've been to Buddhist monasteries in California or co-ed. You know, and I've been in a Zen center where they've had abbesses, so I'm familiar with that. So I said, well, you know, and then we had this huge problem you know about, because you were on the board of the nuns. You know, this last year, a year and a half ago, so a year, 3 months ago or so, there was this major controversy and very painful controversy in Theravadan Buddhism around ordaining women as full nuns, because you're not really supposed to do that anymore, because the nuns' lineage died out and no one's authorized to start it again, and if you start it again you're doing something unauthorized, and so you can't do that, and only you can only do things that are authorized, but no one's authorized to reauthorize. And if you reauthorize yourself, that means you're deluded and you can't do that and you're breaking the rules. And there's all this misogyny and all this kind of, you know, gender conflict, and it was an embarrassing mess that I'm embarrassed to even be part of Buddhism because of it. The only redeeming factor, I don't know if redeeming, but that whole event. So by that time, there were all already nuns and an abbess, and you know, I thought once I went the route of nuns, I thought, let's just go all the way and make it an abbess. That's a strong statement. So I felt really happy with that. And also then I didn't have to worry as much about changing some of the stories, you know, to have more nuns, because if the abbess has a strong role, then I don't have to worry too much about the gender balance, because then the head honcho is a woman, I thought. And so that's the story behind the abbess. But then the dedication was inspired directly out of the conflict a year and a half ago of the nuns and the monks, because it happened just around the time when we were putting this together, and so it was kind of on my mind. It's dedicated to the fellowship of monks, nuns, and lay people practicing on the path together. The idea we're all together, supporting each other and walking the path together. And part of the whole conflict around monks and nuns also involved indirectly a kind of a tension that exists between monastics and lay people. And sometimes there's a hierarchy and elitism that comes together with being monastics. I mean, not inherently, but how people hold it. And I have a lot of respect for the monastic life, but I don't have a lot of respect for the elitism that sometimes comes with that. And so the combination of my concern about the elitism and a concern about the bad position of nuns in that tradition, I wrote the dedication this way. So you might be interested in that.
It's very heartening to me to read it, and that it's an abbess. And so for me, it was part of the teaching that you included it or did it that way, and I'm appreciative of that. But I do get used to it too, so that's really nice.
Yeah, I hope you get really used to it. I hope you get so used to it, it seems like obvious there would be an abyss. So any other? Yes.
Well, that just goes along with what you were saying about the abbess. I was able to spend some time at Tassajara this summer, and the head of Tassajara is an abbess, and she's wonderful. And that image and your story of at the end of the trail or the path was the abbess with the two shovels. And one of my images in Tassajara was walking out of the zendo in the morning, and we were freezing, and I went to get some tea, and there was the abbess raking the ground with the other students. Uh-huh. And same thing. I mean, just powerful, really, really powerful. Yeah. And, you know, so, yes, I appreciate it very much that, you know, that you're including that. So thanks. I haven't read your book yet, so I'll have to get it when you're done.
Bruce.
Just minor correction, I think. Inez had the title, Tales to Sweep You Away.
Oh, that was yours? Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. And I think I came up with Into the Abyss.
A-B-Y-S-S.
No, anyway. A-B-E-S-S.
So the last thing I'd like to say is that one of the surprises for me in doing Buddhist practice was the way in which as I got settled, concentrated, calm, more open, whatever, it also awoke in me creativity. And so kind of a move for a certain kind of aesthetic creativity. And periodically I've put that into action to express that in various things, in sculpture or drawing or painting and different things, sometimes poetry. And it seems that, you know, I don't know if it's always the case, but it's been pointed out by a number of people that there's an overlap between aesthetics, between creativity, and the religious life, a spiritual life. So these stories here are part of that creative world of mine. It's not that creative, but it comes out of a little bit. And I hope that it awakens some imagination and creativity in you, that you realize that the creative side of your life that can also have a place in Buddhism. And I hope that some of you will come up with stories, that some of your wisdom will be shared with the world in creative ways, but that you also will have stories to share. So that seems like enough. So thank you so much for coming, and I appreciate it a lot that you came here to share with the joy of this book. And so, thank you.